Welcome to this session of the symposium. This is session number 171, in case you may be in the wrong room, Personal Beliefs and Public Roles in a 20th Century Ward, a discussion of Mormon lives a year in the Elkton Ward. So if you're in the wrong place, you can leave now. But if you're not, we're happy to have you. My name is Cindy Daly, and I'm one of the panelists today and was asked to serve as the moderator as well. So I'll quickly introduce the panelists, and then I'll give my comments first. And then I've kind of changed the lineup. The way I introduce people is the way that maybe they can plan to speak. My name is Cindy Daly, and I'm a lifelong Salt Lake City member of the church. I have served been in a variety of wards and have been in many different capacities, from Laurel president to missionary to Cub Scout leader to ward activities leader. I've been a Relief Society president twice in singles wards, and I'm currently a Sunday school teacher for the 15-year-olds in my family ward. I have a B.A. in humanities from BYU and an MA in humanities from the University of Chicago, and I presently teach 12th grade English at Alta High School, and I teach classes from the lowest to the highest. I had last year the valedictorian in one class and a boy who wrote on a third grade level in another class, so I have a sense of the trouble we have in education. After I give my remarks, we'll hear from Toby Pingree. Toby is from Walnut Creek, California, and he's an income tax accountant and financial advisor. He has his BS degree from the University of Utah and his MBA from Harvard University. Over the years, he has served in the church as an early morning seminary teacher. He's been a bishop three times and is presently a bishop, I think that's still true, is not, in a singles ward in Walnut Creek, and was a mission president in South America. He and his wife, Phyllis, have been married for 36 years, and they have six children. And I enjoyed what he put on his biographical questionnaire here, because I know several of his children. He says, "I have six children who are addicted to higher education, having logged 65 cumulative years of post-high school education." So I don't know if he's paying for all of that, but maybe that's why he put it down. After Toby, Farrell Lines will speak. Farrell is an attorney in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and is it present or past national president? Okay, past national president of the Coalition for Juvenile Justice, which searches for alternatives to incarceration for teenagers. He's been on the advisory board of Sunstone for 8 years, and in the church, among many other positions, he's been a seminary teacher, a high councilman, and in several bishoprics. After Toby speaks, Scott Abbott will speak. Scott has a PhD from Princeton and is currently associate professor of German at BYU. He's the author of several books and is married to Susan Hansen, and they have seven children. And after we have spoken, Susan Tabor will stand and maybe give some comments on her book and on the things that we have said. Susan has a BA and an MA from Stanford University, and I believe her PhD is the University of Maryland, Delaware. And she's currently an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Development at the University of Delaware. She's written, obviously, the book that we're going to look at today, as well as some other articles, and she and her husband have six children. So this panel has cornered the market on children, I think. So we'll just go ahead. As I was putting together my remarks or thinking about what I was going to say, I have done something that I would kill my students if they did, which is basically quote extensively from a book without giving much analysis. But as I read the book, the thing that struck me most deeply and strongly and has stayed with me as I've thought about the book afterwards, I feel like I know these people, and I read two or three pages that each of them wrote, and yet they are very real people to me. And so I wanted to give you a sense of the voices that blow through this book and the kinds of people that are in the book and were in this ward, And then I'm hoping that the other members of the panel will maybe do some analysis and put it into context and give you some different perspectives. I'd like to start with a quote by a man named Carl Vander Hayden. And it seems to me that his was one of many stories that got to the very essence of why he valued his membership in the Mormon Church. He says, "By joining this church, I have prospered. I'm not rich in the material sense, but in having peace of mind. I'm not rich in my heart. I have learned to love people. Before, I was so indifferent, but now I have sincere love for each one of this ward. I wish I was a Mormon long, long before I was baptized. I think I might have been able to comfort a lot of people at times. If I had had the priesthood in the prisoner of war camp, I might have stayed with somebody who was dying and comforted him. At that time, everybody was just for himself, but if I had had the priesthood, maybe I would have had extra strength. In Korea, seeing people sick and wounded, I would have been able to help them." That was one of many comments like that in the book, and something that I suppose surprised me a little bit. I guess I was expecting people to not have thought so deeply or so sincerely about what it was that gave meaning to their life because of their Mormonism. Now let me just give you a little bit of an introduction so you understand a little bit about the book. In the introduction to this book, Mormon Lives, A Year in the Elkton Ward, Susan Tabor says, "This book is primarily an attempt to portray what it is like to be a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at a particular place and time. The place is Newark, Delaware, and the time is a year from September 1984 to August 1985. The book contains an introduction which explains the genesis of the idea to gather all pertinent ward information as a source for future historians. The information gathering process is detailed, and the questionnaire that was used for oral interviews is outlined. The body of the book, while organized around a year of Elkton Ward activities, beginning with fast and testimony meeting on the first Sunday in September and concluding with the wedding reception of a ward member in late August, is essentially a collection of 95 oral interviews of members whose paths crossed in some way with the ward's organized activities. In the interviews, church members were asked to respond to 8 topics: how the person became a member of the church, family background, working life, church work and the effect of church service in one's personal life and relationships, personal and family life, the impact, if any, of various church practices and beliefs on one's life, people or ideas that had been influential in the person's life, and identification of the greatest societal and church changes within the person's lifetime, and identification of what the church's role should be in society and in the world. Although all of the members began responding to the same basic questions, I thought the responses were surprisingly broad in scope, even though it was apparent that many of these people shared common experiences more than I would have supposed. As people talked about their families, church participation, ward callings, the struggle to keep the commandments, finding answers to prayers, frustrations, priesthood blessings, and the presence of God in their lives, I was struck overwhelmingly by their individuality, their sincerity, impatience, longings, desires, for lack of a better word, judgmentalness, contradictions, humor, and the poetry of their words as they struggled to explain what it meant to them to be Mormons. Almost all of the members who appeared in the book held at least one and often multiple callings in the ward. While some members said they would never turn down a calling because they felt that each one was inspired, others had asked to be released because they felt like they were not doing a good job. One particular member said she became very discouraged and asked to be released from the young women's program after 2 of the girls became pregnant. Many felt the burden of their calling, some struggling to become equal to the task, others struggling to balance the calling with familial and work obligations. What I found most appealing, though, was the core meaning many of the members had been able to glean from their calling, extracting sublime spiritual enlightenment from concrete service, often grudgingly and imperfectly accomplished. 2 women who had served as Relief Society presidents talked about the understanding and compassion that comes from becoming involved in people's lives and problems. Both said they had learned not to judge, although one woman said she had become so good at seeing others' points of view that she said, "Sometimes I feel wishy-washy." An elders' quorum president struggled to be patient with the members of his quorum. He said, "I feel like I'm dragging people along. I guess I have to be patient, but I can't believe they don't live up to their commitments." Another man referred to the men in his quorum as 138 duds. One woman spoke about how much she enjoyed being in the nursery. "I loved the little doll babies." A former gospel doctrine teacher spoke of the intellectual challenge he had enjoyed preparing his lesson, and two men spoke of the great spirituality they had felt as members of the High Council, although one man said, "When I was on the High Council, I disliked sitting on courts. I don't like having to be judgmental. I don't feel we do enough subsequently to rehabilitate the so-called sinner." The callings that were most contradictory were, of course, home teaching and visiting teaching. There were many people in both camps, those who felt the inability to give legitimate help, those who had heartily appreciated visits and blessings of the home teachers, those who felt overwhelmed by the numbers of members to be visited and the impossible distances to be crossed in order to fulfill their calling. One man, a home teacher, admitted, "I feel very few home teachers are in a position to give legitimate help to inactive members who have problems." And then an inactive member said, "I'd give anything to see the home teachers more often. He'll, the home teacher, take any question and I can tell him anything I think. No matter how heretical it is, he doesn't fall over or have a heart attack." My favorite visiting teaching story was told by a woman named Beulah Summers. She said, "I do not enjoy being visited by teachers who bring 5 or 6 children. One day they came when we were having guests for dinner. I had the things to make a pie set out on the kitchen table. I shut the doors, but they don't lock. When I went back to finish, I found the cream cheese all matted up in a wad. Once I went out after they left and found that they had taken our neighbor's wood pile and thrown it all down a hill." The bishop of the ward was able, I think, to distill the essence of these callings had on people's lives. He said, "My ideal is to treat all people all the time the way I do in my very best moments as a bishop. I would like to treat my students and colleagues that way. One of the primary reasons the church is powerful in people's lives is that it compels them to move into a role where they have to act for God." As people talked about their most rewarding experiences, the events that came up again and again were priesthood blessings, answers to prayers, familial relationships, and camaraderie among church members. Many men talked about how satisfying it was to be able to bless their wives and children and other ward and community members. Many members felt they had been the recipient of a miraculous priesthood blessing. One man who had been seriously burned in an explosion at work said, "I learned about the priesthood when I received a blessing after the explosion at Avon. I received miracles and the assurance of the Holy Ghost." Another young man spoke about his patriarchal blessing. He said, "The biggest effect the priesthood has had on me was my patriarchal blessing. It's always a comfort, and it always makes me feel spiritual. That's a miracle in itself, that I'm moved to have a soft heart." Another woman said, "My son Brian is alive and well and has use of both his hands thanks to the church and a priesthood blessing he received." I must admit, after having read how important the priesthood had been to these men, the comments from a 20-year-old struck me as a bit hollow for women. Receiving the Melchizedek priesthood opened my eyes to the authority that God's given us. Being able to give blessings to people and have the faith to heal, wow. It's neat to be able to let the Holy Ghost take over what you say. I don't know where I'd be without the priesthood. I guess the young women's program helps the girls a lot, too. They can build friendships there. I read enviously as person after person talked about the frequent answers to prayers they had received. I guess I was a bit surprised by how closely many members felt God was in their lives. Parents talked about prayers to have children that were answered. A woman spoke about asking God to give her an answer loud and clear about a stake primary meeting. She said, "One day Colleen Pierce called me and we got on the subject of the primary. Suddenly she came out with what the Elkton ward needed and I thought, that's it, that's what I will teach. It was loud and clear." My favorite line about prayers being answered came from a woman whose assurance astounded me. She said, "I don't go seeking after signs, but when I say a prayer, I expect it to be answered. If need be, right then and there." Most often, though, people talked about a continuous and steady sense that God heard and answered their prayers. Thomas Hearn said, "If I'm having a problem in anything, I will stop and ask for God, God's guidance, and I find that it works. While many people expressed a desire to go to the temple, and many others said that it was one of the most satisfying things they had done to have their family sealed to them, I particularly liked Imogene Meekin's disclosure. She said, "Going to the temple impresses me quite a bit. I don't get there often, but I get very tense when I'm in there. It's almost like God is watching over my shoulder to see what I'm doing. I take it very seriously. It's the only thing I can think of that gets to me." Members talked about their membership and participation, that while it was often exhausting, as one woman put it, without other people, it, reading the New Testament and then trying to follow Jesus' teachings by herself, was an empty way to practice religion. One man talked about the practical help he had received from other members, another about the value of each person in the ward for what he or she was able to contribute. While some members had joined the church and were active because of profound spiritual conversions, others had joined for more practical purposes. One man said he and his wife joined because we looked to see what kind of church we wanted to raise a family in. The Mormon church provided what we thought was a friendly atmosphere, a very practical atmosphere. This man had, however, felt pressured to join. He said, "I think we would have waited a year to be baptized, but the missionaries pressured us. They only have a couple of months to do it, and they want to get people in the water." Many people spoke of their struggle to reconcile church expectations with their own personal views. One woman spoke of her unease with telling small primary children, "The Lord wants us to get married and have a family." She says, "I didn't feel comfortable saying that even to small children, because not every young girl is going to be married. Not every young girl is going to have children. Do we make them feel that if they don't, they're not going to be the way the church wants them to be?" I said, "And he wants you to grow up and be happy." Another man was uncomfortable with the church's hardcore, this are his words, church's hardcore missionary role. Another woman was distraught over what she saw as the church's discrimination toward homosexuals. Quoting her, "Certainly I believe in chastity no matter what one's orientation is, but the church can't seem to find a key to help these people." Another man, an inactive member, was uncomfortable with continuous direct revelation. Quoting him, "When the Lord says everything, the individual becomes nothing." Several people talked about their dislike of the programs and lack of focus on gospel basics. One woman put it like this, "We tend to put the church's checklist before the human soul." Many people felt left out, single people, divorced people, elderly people, members of member families. One inactive member voiced her concern this way, "I find the idea that we can all be together very comforting. I'm not sure I entirely understand how it works in a situation like ours where John may never change. He's always saying, 'I'm not a joiner.' They tell you if you live righteously and worthily, you don't have to worry about it. Suppose I manage to accomplish this and he doesn't. What if I don't want to give him up?" Another inactive member explained his choice quite easily. "I have no problem with the church other than just that I was bored." Another woman quit attending because she felt that the expectations were insurmountable. Perhaps my favorite part of reading the book were the beautiful contradictions and one-liners that people blurted out. Ingrid Adams said, "I've not been to the temple. I've not done my temple work. I haven't had my patriarchal blessing. I feel that I'm going to be Relief Society president." Lisa Welch told of a confrontation with her future father-in-law. "I went to the stake center with the missionaries to see the Christmas broadcast." This is while she was investigating the church. "Kevin was there with his parents. His father started questioning me, giving me a hard time. He said, 'You're married, don't you go around my son.' I said, 'Well, I can't help it if I'm not divorced. I'm having a hard time tracking down my ex-husband.' I said to Kevin, 'Don't you ever leave me alone with your father again.'" Ann May said, "Keeping the Sabbath day holy is probably the hardest thing that I have had to do because I've never made a clear distinction between what is work and what is breathing. I know some of the sisters think that doing the dishes is work, and I don't. I thought it was being cleanly." 19-year-old Diana Cannon admitted, "Except for life plan and sex, my parents and I are in agreement on everything." She also said, "I'd like to be a more spiritual person and come to the point where I didn't have to rely so much on what I think, but more on how I feel. I'd also like to own a Jaguar someday." Eileen Johnston, a dentist, stood at the pulpit and asked this question. I'd like to propose a question to the young women. What would you do with the rest of your life if tonight the angel Moroni stood at the foot of your bed and said, "Young woman, you will never marry in this temporal life"? The reading is compelling through these 90. The reading is compelling, although 95 interviews is a lot to read. I don't know how Susan could have given a sense of the ward without including so many voices. And even though 95 was a lot, I still missed not hearing from the primary kids, the mutual kids, the excommunicated members, and the investigators. When I closed the book, I cared about these people. I wanted them to be happy. I also disagreed with them and was envious of those who felt God's abiding presence in their life. These rank-and-file members responding to a questionnaire because the bishop asked them to, but reading their words is poetic. Linda Callery on page 219 of the book put it perfectly. Sometimes at church we want everyone to see how good we are. I like to see the other side, the side that's vulnerable. It strengthens me. It strengthened me too.
I found reading the book exciting and stimulating, as Cindy has mentioned it is. It's a rich, broad spectrum of personal lives of people who are Latter-day Saints and who have had the influence of the church impact their lives in very, very wide spectrum of feelings and experiences, and it was a very interesting thing to read. I wish that I had a book like that about every ward I've moved into, because you feel like you feel like you know those people in that ward, in the Elkton ward, probably as well or better than you do of the wards that you've lived in. It was a wonderful thing to have. I think Susan is to be commended. It was a formidable task. Apparently, I met with her earlier today, and she didn't realize she was going to be writing the book when you started. They wanted to have some kind of a compilation, oral history of this ward, and they, I guess, the Bushmans, I guess, are really the sort of ones who started it all. They're kind of into this thing, both of them. And he was the bishop, and Claudie's wife, who was sort of everything else in the ward at one time or another. But then after these oral interviews and what they gathered, sort of evolved into something to be published. They spent this year gathering it. That was, 9 years ago is when they finished. And then it's taken her that much time to finish it up. And in the meantime, she had some very traumatic things happen in her life, as the book mentioned. She had a child die shortly after that, which is certainly traumatic. And her husband was called as bishop to replace Bishop Bushman after that, too, which is a very traumatic experience, too. What I liked about the book, as I've mentioned, I think you just had a feeling for these people. There's some wonderful people out there who kind of told you the intimate things about themselves, about how they felt, what they thought, and as Cindy mentioned, a lot of contradictions, a lot of simplifications, a lot of irrational things said, but a lot of very hard, well-thought-out things, too. She said the intent, her idea was to have a capture a snapshot of a ward at a particular time and show, sort of leave a historical view of what that ward was like. It's a ward that, to me, doesn't represent particularly a wide spectrum of wards within the LDS Church, however. It's an eastern ward where the church is a minority of the minorities. I mean, the church really is not very relevant in most eastern communities. And I think you'd have a somewhat different spectrum of a different view of a ward that was in one of the western states where while still a minority, we're large enough of a proportion of the population to have some impact and be recognized. That would be a different kind of a ward to a ward along the Wasatch Front where it's, you know, two blocks square and everybody knows everybody and a generally fairly homogeneous, I think, ward. And another type of ward in the world, the church's world today, would be a third world ward, which would be very interesting to have if someone make history of it. You can't have everything, but it would be wonderful to have those things. And I thought as I was reading this, how great it would be to have had a history of, say, the 19th Ward in Salt Lake City 100 years ago, in 1894, what we would read about those people and their lives and what were their concerns. And maybe the Nauvoo Ward in 1850 years ago, that would be interesting too, to find out what Mormons were like, what the common everyday working class, raised their family, Mormons were thinking. We get a lot of what prophets were saying, which is important, but what were the lives like and what were the feelings that people had at that time? We got it in some journals and things like that, but to had a composite view of a ward, I think would have been rewarding. In what people express as their beliefs, I found a wide range of views. One thing that I found somewhat common, and I have not found generally throughout the church, was their almost a universal concern about feminism at that time. And maybe it was because of the time and where the ward was. There had been some things that go on, but everybody seemed to have an opinion about it. And my experience is that while I have opinions about it, I'm not sure that a lot of people in the church care all that much about it. Large men, even the majority, don't. There were things mentioned like Seventh East Press, and even Boyd K. Packer got mentioned as having irritated somebody in the book. There are some of the people you loved. I think Cindy made comment on many of them. There's one that I particularly liked, G. Fred Summers, who came out of East Garland, Utah, escaped from a farm and got to, I don't know, Nell, did you know him? G. Fred, he was at Cornell. Summers was his name, G. Fred Summers. He got his PhD at Cornell, and he went on, and he, I guess, taught at the University of Delaware, but he was the one who I think would fit very comfortably with us here today. It was a marvelous explanation of how his life had gone, and he was 71 years old. He and his wife, I guess, ran the genealogy center there in Newark, Delaware. There are some, things that I would suggest could be added to the book or changed that I think would be healthy for it. One is, I had problems. I didn't sit and read this cover to cover, and so it would be different if you read it consistently, but I had trouble keeping up with all the people that were in it. You'd hear about Mullins. The first meeting was held in the Mullins home, and I kept having to go back. Floyd Mullins? Is that, I think, was the name? Cloyd, yeah. And it was somewhat disconcerting because people in their personal descriptions would refer to people quickly, and you weren't quite sure who they were talking about. And it would be helpful to have an easier way to sort of flip back and forth and get references about that. And I would like to have seen some additional pictures. The ones that were there were marvelous, but more pictures with identifying some of these people and really seeing what they're like, because a picture is worth 1,000 words a lot of times. Finally, I guess one thing, Cindy mentioned some things she would like to have seen, heard more from the primary, the young people, and some of the inactives were the ones that I felt were missing in the book. There's a chapter entitled "The Empty Benches," and I expected to have some, some real strong rhetoric about the questioning the validity of what Joseph Smith said or did, or some flaming feminist demanding the priesthood, or someone bringing up the subject about hypocrisy among the members, or something that a church leader had done. And there really was very, very little of that. And I think to really get a full view of a ward, you've got to, at least every ward I've lived in has had some people of that nature. You don't see much of them. And maybe it's hard to get them to come and to say something about it, but I think that would have certainly rounded out the book. There were seven mentioned in this book, The Empty Benches, and I expected they'd be far less committed to the church, but they had some things like Lyle Hipps was the first one. He wants to do more. I just wish that they would ask me more often. And Bernard Cowrie, I always enjoyed home teaching. I want to go to the temple and be, that certainly doesn't sound like an empty bencher. E.J. Arnold, who was one, he'd been active for 20 years and been a clerk to four ward bishops. But he said, I never regretted the joining the church and never regretted what he'd done. Pat Summers, her son was alive and well because of priesthood blessings and family home evenings. She described it as something she enjoyed. Ellen Lilly, who was one who had been inactive for 4 years. Her husband just found it was too much to do, and they sort of had a word of wisdom problem, but that was about the worst of it. Nancy Quinn is one that I really loved. I want to read about her because she is terrific. She said, Nancy, and I think she's was she active or not? I don't know.
She had to,
at that time
she was becoming active.
But she said, when Howard and I got into the excavating business full time, I stopped going to college. I'll pick it up again when the kids are older. We're going to school Eric at home the way we're schooling Tabitha. I used to drive a dump truck. I sanded job sites and whipped down dirt until the day before Tabitha was born. When this huge pregnant person jumped out of the dump truck at the quarry, it made men a little politer. I didn't have to wait in line as long for my stone. I'd like to meet Nancy someday. And finally, there was Henry Tingey, who was grew up in Logan, Utah, went through a number of years. He was married in the temple. Nobody talked to him about going on a mission, so he didn't, as he said, and just he and his wife kind of encountered each other. They went to the bishop and decided to get married in the temple, and they got married in the temple. And then he pursued an academic career that he ended up in there. But over the years in Minneapolis and places like that, he just somehow drifted out of activity in the church. And he talked about the price of inactivity. His wife talked about why his wife didn't come. How one day she went to church. I guess it was an Old Testament commentary, and they spent the whole time trying to figure out what happened in the dialogue between Adam and Eve, and that was the last time she went to church, according to him. But it was kind of a touching story as he talked about how he's now the Sunday school president and how he realized that he had missed so much by being active in the church and was sorry for it. But I wasn't sorry that I read the book, and I don't think we should be sorry we have it. It's a wonderful contribution to tell us something about a group of Mormons, and I would hope we might see more of these sometime.
I'm delighted to be here today. It's especially nice to be on a panel with Tony. He and I knew each other 20 years ago in Albuquerque, and I'm not sure we'd seen each other for 20 years since he left. I just thought it was wonderful to read the book, and I recommend it to any of you, Mormon Lives, A Year in the Yelkton Ward. It's really one of the more profound and intriguing books that I've read, LDS books, in some period of time in several ways, and I'm going to talk about those. But we really owe a great debt to you, Susan, and to Bishop Bushman and those that participated, because it really is just a unique contribution to our church. The first thing that I noticed in it was that this was an Eastern ward, which is quite different. I learned a long time ago that there are really two churches that we belong to. There's one church in Utah, and there's another church outside of Utah. And it was really refreshing to see how things operated here. Now, you need to know that I was born and raised in New Mexico and have lived most all of my life outside of Utah, except for a couple of years at BYU and a year working here in Utah. So that's my perspective. But I first became aware of that phenomenon when I was on my mission in Western Canada. Now, they had strong branches in Edmonton, Alberta, and in Vancouver, British Columbia. And we had a number of government workers and attorneys and college professors. And Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, they would grouse at the manuals, both the priesthood and the Sunday school manuals, as they were espousing our LDS, or our Constitution of the United States, as being superior to anything else in the world. And they had some very compelling arguments as to why the Canadian system was equally as good as ours, and that just constantly bothered them. They also hated to pick up their hymnal and see one of the songs, Utah, We Love Thee, when none of them had ever lived in Utah and never ever wanted to live in Utah, but were still active members of the church. Then I went to law school in Washington, D.C., and had another interesting experience there. We met a lot of people who had been living in Washington from Utah for 20, 30, some of them even 40 years. But when you met them for the first time and asked, are you a Washingtonian? I certainly am not. I'm a Utahn. And that reflected in everything that they did in the wards. And one of the most dramatic things that happened, we had a beautiful chapel in Washington, D.C., made of marble right on 16th Street up from the White House, next to the Italian embassy with an angel Moroni on the top. And it was just one of the highlights of the city. But all of a sudden, a few blacks started moving into the neighborhood. And these Utahns became very paranoid and decided we just couldn't have church members being involved in that kind of thing. So they sold the chapel to the Moonies. And it's still a landmark today, whereas the singles ward now has to meet in a building downtown. And now we have a nice black congregation in that area there who meet in a rundown storefront, while the Moonies still enjoy our beautiful chapel. After law school, I moved back to New Mexico. And again, I realized the difference between the Utah church and the rest of the church. A bulletin came out from our priesthood that says, there shall be no guitars in sacrament meetings. Well, a few weeks after that, a lady in our ward who was a teacher at the University of New Mexico brought a group of her people up to sing in sacrament meeting. And it was a beautiful, beautiful number that they did, I think two of them, but unfortunately they were accompanied by a guitar. Every iron rotter in the ward wanted her run out of town and tried for her membership because it was opposed to the church bulletin, and it caused quite a stir in our ward for a number of weeks. It just so happened that a couple of months after that, my wife and I came to Salt Lake to visit her mother who lives in the Bonneville Stake. And those of you who are from Utah know that a number of our general authorities live in that stake. And it happened to be their state conference Sunday. And it was fun to go to that state conference being from out of Utah because on the stand was the prophet and four apostles and a number of other general authorities. In the afternoon session, the music was provided by a girls' chorus from East High School that was beautiful. But unfortunately, it was accompanied by two guitars. I didn't dare go back to New Mexico and let them know that in Utah it's permissible to have guitars because it would have tried the faith of all of our iron rotters. A couple of more incidents, recent incidents. We have youth trips where we go to the temple. And, of course, in New Mexico we're 8 hours from the temple, so we go 8 hours down and 8 hours back in a motel room and the meals. But whenever we go to the temple, we have to take all of our own names. So that's just one of the things that we have to do. So we all work hard and we get 1,000 or 1,200 names so that our kids can go. But it always astounds my brother, who lives just 20 blocks from the temple, saying, well, our kids go to the temple, you know, four times a year. We never have to provide those names. We also have interesting things in temples, you know. I happened to be in Utah the Sunday that they announced the Vernal Temple. And I was in the priesthood meeting in the Bonneville ward, and the men were really excited about that. And one of them raised his hands and says, isn't it wonderful that we're having this great surge of temple building in the church? Well, I raised my hand and said, it's wonderful, but unfortunately the surge is in Utah. I said, I can hardly wait till they announce another temple now for Cedar City, Tremont, and Panguitch, and Price, and then maybe we can get a temple in New Mexico for our 20 stakes that are 16 hours from the temple. And they didn't appreciate that very much. Also in the building program, it's interesting, inside and outside Utah, as we found out recently in New Mexico. We have a large stake there in Albuquerque, and our leaders would like to divide it. We have in our stake center three wards, two of them that are over 600 and ready to be divided. So we bought some property and put in an application for a new stake center, only to find out that we couldn't build it because they now have a new policy here in the church that if you have a building 15 miles from a current building that doesn't have two or three wards in it, you can't have another chapel. Well, unfortunately, we have a community 15 miles north of Albuquerque that has a small little two-phase chapel that only has one ward in it. And the stake president said, well, I'm not going to send all of my members on a 30-mile round trip every Sunday, so we're sitting there now and can't build a building. But it was interesting, when he was up for conference, he asked, well, is this the same policy in Utah? And they said, oh, no, not up here. Up here, you just have to go over to the next stake. And if there's a building in the next stake 15 blocks over that isn't filled, then you just fill that, and then you can build a new chapel. So anyway, it's interesting to just see the differences in things. Another thing that I noticed, a thread throughout the whole book, was the distances and how it's so unique to have distances. Now, you've got to remember, this Elkton ward encompassed three states, the states of Delaware and Maryland and Pennsylvania. Granted, it was in the corner. It wasn't all of those states, but there were long distances that all of these people had to encounter. And another story from New Mexico again. We have a very large stake in Albuquerque there, or had at that time. It's been divided a couple of times since. But I was on the High Council a number of years ago, and we went 120 miles one direction and 120 miles another and 100 another. So we were constantly on the road, and we really enjoyed it, but it was a lot of travel. And one of our young stake presidency members just about wore out his car trying to keep track of all of that. And then he happened to be transferred to Utah by his company. And he and his wife found a piece of property down in the Tony Cottonwood area to build a home. Unfortunately, it delayed in being constructed, and so they had to get an apartment, and they lived about 4 to 6 months in an apartment. And the apartment was about 2 miles out of the ward, but they started going to the ward because they wanted their kids to be active. But they were quite chagrined after a couple of weeks to have both the bishop and the Relief Society president tell them, well, don't expect any home teachers or visiting teachers until you move into the ward, because it's way too much to ask our people to go the 2 miles out of our ward boundaries to visit you every month. Well, he took that in great stride, but we've had lots of laughs about that, about the differences again. I was also impressed in the book about the content. This is really the lives of ordinary members. Now, I challenge you to go into to Deseret Book or any other LDS bookstore and find books about common LDS people. There might be some, but I haven't found many. It's generally about general authorities or successful LDS businessmen or rich athletes who are LDS. But this is a book really about the common people, just the people that keep things alive. And we've got to remember that for 164 years in our church, these are the people, the backbone, that we should have been writing more about. These are the people in the wards and branches that just keep things moving and go Sunday after Sunday and keep things going. These are the people in the congregations that have been willing to overlook and forgive uninspired leaders who've led them into questionable business ventures and colonization in Bear Valleys, which had to be abandoned because of obvious drawbacks, dubious political alliances, years of nepotism, doctrines now discredited, doomed welfare projects, generational distances of general authorities, foolish ward divisions, poor placement of chapels when it was obvious how cities were growing, and anti-intellect. The last statement sounds a little harsh, and so I'd like to back up a little bit. You know, over the years, we have had many, many, many wonderful, righteous leaders, a few who have even been visionary. But unfortunately, we have so many who aren't, and yet, Sunday after Sunday, the people are still in the trenches compensating for that weakness and continuing the church alive. The Elkton Saints really depicted for me this massive faith and dedication. Just a handful, you know, of people there that were trying to get a toehold in that part of the eastern United States, and it was just wonderful. I appreciated also the honesty. That was the most important thing for me, was the honesty of these members. I remember in Albuquerque again, shortly after going there, and I was on the High Council, and I was gone a lot in my travels, but one Sunday I happened to come back to my home ward. And a couple of weeks before, an army officer had transferred into Albuquerque, and he had been called just immediately as the high priest group leader. Well, he was teaching the high priest that morning, and the lesson was, by the time you become a high priest, you have absolute faith, and you never have a doubt or a question. Well, I didn't know the man, but he got up and gave this impassioned thing, and then there were a couple of others that stood up and said the same thing. Yes, I'm a high priest, and I've never had a doubt, and I've never had a question, and it seemed a bit self. So I finally raised my hand and I said, well, obviously I'm not as righteous as any of you, but I think I'm equally as committed, but unfortunately I have a few doubts. I've been haunted since high school days about this Negro problem. This is before the revelation. How you can justify God, who is just and loves all of his children and wanting all of his children to come back to him, you know, could have this kind of discriminatory thing. And also polygamy has always bothered me, even though all of my great-grandparents were polygamists and that's why they were run out of Utah and had to move to Mexico. But how all of the tragedies that I saw and the heartache from polygamy and now the doctrine that some people preach that celestial marriage is polygamal marriage and that in the next life I'm going to have to live polygamy too, and that really bothers me. Well, it kind of hushed the group, and the lesson stopped kind of quickly, and it was interesting later in the morning, I happened to go around a corner in the building there, and I heard the high priest group leader talk to one of the other men. Oh, and by the way, I've been asked to, several weeks before he came, to give a fireside the next Sunday for the high priest, and he just said, Brother Lyons is a dangerous man. We've got to cancel that fireside. Obviously, we can't have him speaking to the people in the ward. Well, I found out later also that he called the state president and complained about this, and also complained because I was a Democrat. And the state president assured him that he was also a Democrat and that he had full confidence in Brother Lyons or he wouldn't be on the high council. So that put the end of that. But I think a lot of us here have had those kinds of experiences where we dare open up our thoughts in a ward meeting and immediately become threatened because of the people who don't want to talk about or listen to things like that. And yet here were these people of giants, just struggling to make ends meet, struggling to pay tithing, struggling to do their home teaching, struggling to be active, struggling with inactive spouses and all of the other things that go on, and yet were willing to open up their lives and bear their souls. There were a lot of things, as the others have talked about, and so I won't talk to them about the specific things, doubts that they had, but most everyone was willing to say, I'm committed and I have a testimony, but. I wish we could do that. In the epilogue, that was encouraging for me as well, because here these people during this year in the Elkton ward with all of their struggles really did make that toehold, because now 9 years later, those members encompass two wards and two branches as the church continues to grow in that area. And that was impressive to me. In conclusion, every Sunday, as I look around my large ward there in Albuquerque, composed of folks with seemingly perfect faith, and as I examine my total commitment but questioning faith, and with no one to share my frustrations, I often wish that I could spend a year in the Elkton ward. Thank you.
When I first got this book, well, before I got it, when I was talking with Susan about what she was doing, I thought this would be a great book for non-Mormons so they could see what happens in a ward. In fact, I described it to several people as the most wonderful kind of project. People will be able to look right into a ward and understand us. After I read it, I figured it was for me and not for non-Mormons. I'd like to begin just by relating a story about the first time I met Susan. I'd driven to Nashville from New Jersey to look for a house. We were moving there. And I met her husband, Doug, in a priesthood meeting. And he said, "Why don't you come over to dinner?" And I'm not sure when he talked that over with you. But they welcomed me into their home. After a week, I didn't have a place to stay, and they gave me a place to stay. And they're wonderful people. And I think that comes through as we see Susan telling the stories or letting these people tell their stories. She's a woman with a big heart, and she knows what it is to welcome people. And she's welcomed the members of the ward into this book. There's another book that's a set of stories told by people who are fleeing the plague. They leave town because they're afraid of the plague, and they think they'll go outside of town and in the face of the plague, tell stories. And so they do that, and they tell 100 stories. And you know the book. It's Boccaccio's Decameron. And it's a wild book. It's a racy book. It's a book full of kindness and hate, and it's a book about the church and about duplicitous priests and nuns. And it's 100 stories, and in 100 stories you get lots of information. And I think this book is our Decameron, and I think Susan is our Boccaccio. We're used to telling stories in the church that aren't stories but are myths. And that's what you were talking about when you talked about the books you find in the Mormon bookstores. We find myths, people made into bigger things than they really are. Magnifying their calling means making their calling bigger than it really is. And and that's what we find in books about Mormons. And that's not what we find here at all. Here we find snippets of autobiography. And Susan and I were talking just before this, and she said that what's nice is that it's all so honest. And I said, "I'm not sure any of it's honest, but at least it's what the people said." And each one of them is telling a story. And each one is constructing their life. And they've gone back through their life and seen certain things as meaning something. And in that construction, and they're short, a page and a half or 2 pages, they tell us their whole life. And of course, because it's so short, they leave us wondering. And Cindy mentioned the one story about the woman who was married but couldn't find her husband. He'd walked out. Didn't she have one child?
Yeah, she was pregnant.
Oh, no. Anyway, the father of this man who was obviously interested in her and helping to teach her, and he's the one who baptized her. The father didn't want her coming near his son. And now I want to know from Susan, what happened.
It's in the book. They got married.
So they got married.
They now have three children and live in Florida.
See? The book leaves us sometimes without endings, but with intriguing questions. There are people just telling their stories. A lot of the stories show them in a bad light. And I think Richard Bushman set a tone for that when he told that wonderful story about his daughter, who he said, Claudia and I were always strict parents, and our two oldest children wanted to show us that that there were other ways, and they went their own ways, and Claudia found this wonderful man to marry, and we were so happy when she found him because she became more lively and she was a better woman because of this man. He wasn't a Mormon. They were planning the wedding reception, and he wanted champagne at the reception. He wanted to do things right. And then there was a big argument. So I've been the stake president in Boston, he said, and I can't have people from Boston coming down and seeing champagne at my daughter's wedding. And the story goes on and on and on and on. And they don't get married for a whole year because they can't figure out whether to have champagne at the wedding or not. And finally, Richard goes down one morning to his study, and he's saying a prayer that this man, whom he really likes, will understand why he can't have champagne at the wedding. And suddenly, he feels like he has inspiration. And the inspiration is, my daughter needs to know that I love her and care for her and forget the champagne, or let's have the champagne. And he calls her, and they have champagne. And I think that's an incredible story. This is the bishop of this ward. And what any idiot would figure out within a half hour of it being broached, it takes him a whole year to figure out. These people are willing to tell those kinds of stories. And it's real autobiography. And each story is moving in a different way. I flipped back and forth to the pictures. I wanted to know who these people were. In the middle of a story, what does that person look like? And I remember especially the primary presidency, as they were telling their stories. I kept going back, who's saying this? I can't believe this person's saying this. And I thought I'd read just two little passages here. I can't believe this presidency could work together. But they seemed the best of friends. It's page 59. The one says, this is a counselor. In 1980, I got involved with a group that was trying to make sure that Jimmy Carter's White House Conference on Families wasn't taken over by anti-family groups, the pro-abortion, pro-ERA, pro-homosexuality groups. Jimmy Carter had stacked it so they would run the conference, and we were trying to undermine what they were doing. Through that, I became involved with numerous local, state, and national groups. I worked for Right to Life and the Eagle Forum. Well, that's the counselor. Here's the president. When I lived in Utah, we were all told to go to the International Women's Year Conference and vote a certain way. We all did it just like sheep. I'm a little ashamed of that now. We should have studied the issues on our own and voted the way we thought was right. We don't want to be represented as being blind followers because in everything else we are not. In conferences, general authorities say we must pray and gain a testimony about what we have heard. I'm a little ashamed that we did not do that. These women have to meet every week, and we hope they don't talk politics. It's already been mentioned that there are lots of references in this book to feminism and to women in the priesthood. One reading, I just started marking down pages where there were references. And we got page 54, 63, 70, 73, 81, 101, 105, 109, 117, 136, 142. That's just a little section. These women are very interested in what it means to be a woman in today's church. Suggestion was made that maybe this is an odd ward. It's my guess it's not. And I'd love to see this sort of thing in an Orem ward. Although I'm in an Orem ward, and I'm not sure people would talk this openly in our ward. But I'd like to just read a couple of those passages by women that especially moved me. The church's stand on women's issues is like the issue of the blacks and the priesthood in the 60s. That was never brought up in the missionary lessons. When I found out about it later, I thought, this certainly is contrary to everything I believe, the way I was raised, the way I understand the Bible, the way I understand God and his infinite goodness and wisdom. This is something I cannot accept. That woman compares those two strongly. Here's another one. I think the church was badly scarred by its opposition to the women's movement. Or one more. Well, that's probably enough of those. I want to give Susan time. Somebody mentioned already, Cindy, answers to prayers. She was jealous that these people were so close to the Lord and got such strong answers to prayers. You could have picked out just the opposite. These are also people who were not getting answers to prayers. These are people with incredible tragedies in their lives. And in fact, the church is helping them live through that, but not by giving them a blessing and healing the child. In fact, one of the most moving sections for me was the one with Susan's husband, where Doug talks about their daughter with leukemia and says, I blessed her, and I know she'll be all right, something like that. And then later, he and Susan have to come to terms with that. This is a book about miracles. It's also a book about people who don't have those same miracles or have a different sort of miracle. Each person defines that their own way. There's also that story about prayer with Serge Bushman. He says, my father's given me a lot of blessings in my life, most of them because I couldn't sleep. There's a whole story behind that. What about Serge Bushman? Why can't he sleep? And why don't his dad's blessings work so he can sleep? Or maybe they do the night. There must be wonderful comfort between father and son in those evenings as the blessing is given. This is a book full of contradictions. It's full of individual lives, people telling real stories. Two of the people figure that the church is just like their corporation. I work for Marriott. Marriott's great. The church is great. I don't know if the church copied Marriott or Marriott copied the church. And the other one was Shackley. I do Shackley and the church. I'll close with... this is the same woman who was married but not married and whose future husband baptized her. She was so open, so funny. She says, the 5th of January, Kevin was at my house teaching me. He felt prompted to ask me if I knew where the golden plates are. I said they were in Utah. He said, did somebody tell you that or did you just assume that? I know one of them told me. They were there in the archives. I had asked if I wanted to have proof that it was real, could I have proof of it? He had said, yeah, go to Utah and see it in the archives. When Kevin told me this wasn't true, I was devastated. I thought, oh no, the missionaries lied to me. If that isn't real, what else isn't real? I called Elder Steenstra and said, I'm not getting baptized tomorrow. Well, she did. I'm grateful for these stories, and I'm grateful to be part of a church that has people in it that are as diverse and as wonderful and individual as these people. This is a book correlators hate. These are people who believe the strangest things. Martin Luther King was a prophet, and Spencer Kimball wouldn't have had his revelation if Martin Luther King hadn't first done what he did. These are real people, like us, and I'm grateful for them.
Well, it was a little embarrassing sitting here and having people say such nice things about a book which truly was a labor of love. I've done a lot of things in my life, and there was nothing more rewarding and yet also nothing more agonizing than putting that book together. I'd just like to say maybe a few things, answer some of the things that were raised, and talk a little bit about my feelings about it and some of the reactions that people in the community where I live have had to the book. And I should have been taking notes while people were talking, but I thought, well, I don't want to sit up here and scribble. One thing that I quickly became aware of in writing the book was that many choices had to be made as to what would be included and what would not be included. I never counted them, but just from estimating and multiplying, I think I had about 10,000 typewritten pages of these interviews, the transcribed interviews. And the interviews themselves are wonderful reading, but obviously nobody but me probably would have sat down to read them all. So choices did have to be made. Who would be included? There were people that it just killed me to leave out. These were members of my ward, and I loved them, and they had interesting lives, and yet what they had to say did not add enough to the picture of the ward as a ward and how a ward functions that I could include them. I mean, those kinds of choices had to be made. Some choices were made, well, let me talk about the pictures. The pictures, there were many pictures taken. They were taken by members of this record year committee. And, in fact, one of the projects that the record year committee did was to put out a yearbook right after we finished the record year that was mostly pictures, and it had wonderful pictures in it. Well, between that time and the time that I had written the manuscript, I had found a publisher, which took a couple of years. More than a couple. It took a long time to get. It took as long. I had the manuscript nearly finished by the time I began work on my PhD, and I found out that it would be published the same week I defended my dissertation. That gives you an idea of how long it took to find a publisher. And then it took another year and a half to get it published. Anyway, what happened to the pictures was one man died, and whatever he had, and had moved before he died, and whatever he had had was lost. The woman who did the yearbook had made a lot of halftones, but she had sold her farm and her business and moved, and she had done who knows what with the halftones. We went back to the BYU archives. They were wonderful to us. Everything, all our raw materials had been deposited there. They sent me proof sheets of the photos. Some of them weren't very good, but I sent them on to the press. They chose the pictures they wanted, and they didn't want to print very many pictures because it's expensive to print pictures. You know, it would have been nice to have everybody's photo. But all those things sort of impact on what happens. And as far as including children and young people, yeah, you'd like to hear from them. I'm really glad we didn't interview young people because of the legal ramifications of things that might have been had. I had lots of nightmares over the interviews that I conducted with people. I was afraid people were going to come back to me and say, oh, how can you, you know, how could you hold me up to public display like this? I will mention that every person in the book was shown the part of the book that pertained to them and asked to correct any errors and given the opportunity to have a pseudonym. But I didn't offer the opportunity to change their views. I mean, there they were. Feminism, that was another thing that was brought up. And I've been thinking a little bit about this. Partly it's in the book because of my own interest, but also I think it was a big issue in the lives of members of that ward. And perhaps one of the reasons that members felt free to express it was because of the tone set by the bishop of the ward and his wife. I think because of Claudia Bushman's example, mostly, people, and also because of the way that Bishop Bushman treated members of the ward and respected women, and when he spoke to women, he said things such as, you know, what is, well, maybe I'll get him into trouble. I won't quote him. But anyway, he had, because of the way he viewed women's callings and women's contributions and the example of Claudia and her daughters and sons, I would say, it became okay to talk about. And there were people who disagreed. There were people who frankly said, how can people stand at the pulpit and go against what the prophets have told us to do? And there were women who had lived in the ward a lot longer than the bishop, who had worked and who had felt persecuted by other members of the ward and ostracized because they had worked all their lives while raising children. But I think because of their openness, it was able to be expressed. I think it's definitely there in most, I think most women are trying to figure out what their role is and how they can contribute to society and to the church and to take care of their families all at the same time. And just by way of contrast, the ward I lived in Nashville, this was before Scott Abbott came, well, actually, that ward underwent several transformations. And under a previous bishop, birth control, boy, was that a hot topic, and created many divisions in the ward, chiefly because of the attitude of the bishop. So I think that has something to do with it. Now, I've forgotten all the other things I might have commented on, so I'll just talk a little bit about my intentions in writing the book. I had two. I wanted it to be informative for people outside the church, and I wanted it to be sort of a thing that members in the church could identify with and that would feel, you know, they would identify with what people said. And I know there are contradictions in there. I put them there. I mean, people did contradict themselves, and I think people can hold two views to some extent at the same time. They can say, oh, yes, I absolutely believe this, and yet at the same time, some of the things they say show that they really do not believe that in quite the way they think they believe it. And that was interesting to me. But I felt members of the church would read the book and would identify with situations or crises or problems or callings or whatever, and that it would be kind of an emotional experience for them. Well, it's been very interesting because a number of people who are not members of the church in my town have read the book. They have either bought it or they have checked it out of the University of Delaware Library. And of course, I have not heard from everybody who's read it, but people have said to me, thank you for writing this book. It helped me think about things that go on in the Presbyterian Church. It helped me understand my feelings about my own religion. The wife of one of my professors at the University of Delaware, this is really kind of sad, I had never met her before, and I met her at Henry Tingey's funeral this winter. She said, thank you for writing this book and for portraying the spiritual lives of these people. I don't know what religion she is, but she responded on a spiritual level to the book. And those reactions, while I didn't expect them, have made me feel very happy that it has kind of a universal spiritual appeal to some people, at least. I think a lot of times as Latter-day Saints, we think we're the only people with religious feelings or the only people with these thoughts. And I'm thankful I had the opportunity to open up the Latter-day Saint view to other people. Just the other day, I was indulging myself by lying in a chair at the swim club, and a woman whom I have known for a long time, her daughter's the same age as my son, they have gone to school all the time. She said, oh, I've read about your book. And she said, are people's real names in this? I said, well, mostly, yes. And she said, well, how do they feel? You know, did you include all the, you know, the back politics and the things that go on in churches? And I said, well, she said, how did you do this? And I said, well, you know, and I wasn't quite sure what she was getting at. I said, well, it's not really an expose. I said, people knew, you know, what would be in that, and they were willing to participate in the project. So I don't know if she's read it yet or not, but she thought maybe it was the dirt on the Mormon church or something. And that brings up kind of another thing is, at the time I was writing it, my husband was the bishop, and it was kind of, you know, I wanted to tell the truth, and the truth was not always the way, you know, the ensign would tell it. And I worried about the ward members' reactions, and, you know, as a Latter-day Saint does, I always ascribe divine providence to the way things work out. And I think maybe the reason it took so long to find a publisher was my husband had to finish being the bishop before this book could be published. I don't know, but it certainly that was how the time went. It was a wonderful thing to be involved in. I'm thankful I had the chance to do it. And somebody mentioned my welcoming the ward members into my life. I would like to say thank you to my ward members who welcomed me into their lives. They were just incredible. And I had the whole project was a wonderful thing in our ward because people were happy to participate in it. They bore their testimonies. They said, I'm not just going to be a name on the records of the church. My story will be in the records of the church. Whether they ended up in the book or not, their stories are there. So I'll just quit now, and if people want to make comments or ask questions, anybody can say anything.
Thank you to all the panelists and to Susan. 6 o'clock, and we have until 6:15. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask Susan, I'm sure she'd be happy to answer them, or any of the other panelists. I'll get to you in just a second. Before you go, if you are interested in the book, and I think you couldn't have had four more enthusiastic supporters than we four, Susan has brought a little order form that would allow you 20% discount off the price of the book. If you're interested, those will be on the table. If you'll ask your question, I'll repeat it into the microphone, or maybe Susan can just come up and do it so we don't have to go around in a circle, and you can repeat it into the microphone.
I thought maybe they'd ask you guys. You mentioned in the introduction that all of the materials are going to the BYU archives to be used 25 years later.
Well, that's true. The question is, all the materials went to BYU archives to be available in 25 years, and did all the members grant permission? I really wish we had made it 100 years. I mean, 25 years goes by very quickly. Yes, we did have the foresight to have people sign a release that says, I agree to be interviewed, and I know that this material will be deposited in an archive. We weren't sure where, and will be available to scholars in the future. And I think we told people it would be sealed for 25 years. So, yeah, people did give permission. And, I mean, one of the things I liked about working with the Bushmans is that they attempted to have everyone in the ward who wanted to take part feel they could take part in this project. It was not just the university people over here studying the rest of the ward. Anyone who wanted to come into the project was invited to do so, and people felt a real sense of ownership and participation in this project. I mean, how could they help it when they were dragged out to have their picture taken during primary and so on? Okay.
What about the personal bishop's journal that you kept?
Well, he kept journal of his activities and thought, I don't know what's in it. I never saw it, but he did keep a bishop's journal, and I don't know what's in it. And I guess it's sealed. I don't know if it's sealed for 25 years or for some period of time. He asked the Relief Society president to keep a journal, and also one of the people on the committee was in charge of journals and collected anyone who wanted to keep a journal of their church activities for a year could give a copy to that person, and some people did, turn in copies of their journals as they pertain to their activities in the church.
Are they also in the archives?
I believe so. The Bushmans were in charge of getting the stuff to the archives, but I believe that went. I'm not sure. You'd have to ask them. Yes. The question is, did I personally conduct all the interviews? There were 140 interviews. I personally did about half of them. Another woman who worked with me did about most of the other half, and then there were a few people who did two or three each. So, it was a
a group effort all the way. I was the one who wrote the questionnaire, and you know, the committee said, oh yeah, these are good things, and made some suggestions of things they'd like to see included. And then we kind of followed the questionnaire, but if people got started, the goal of our interviews was to get people talking and speaking about things that were important to them. And so maybe we would go on at greater length about one aspect and skip over other parts that weren't so meaningful to them. Yes. Well, we had modest funding. Bishop Bushman got a small grant from the Lilly Foundation, which had a program of doing congregational studies. And also one of the centers, and I don't remember the name of it, I'm embarrassed, at BYU, contribute a lesser amount. And so the funding just went for things like supplies, tapes, paying people to transcribe the tapes, things like that. Hal?
Have you been contacted by the church to kind of expose or share this effort through official church channels? And secondly, can you recommend this project to other wards? And it sounds fine until you hear 10,000 pages. And that kind of, you know, kills it.
Okay. Two questions. Have I been invited by the official church to share this with other people? No. Although I was invited to speak, not at this most recent BYU Women's Conference, but at the one before. And I was approved by, you know, whoever approves speakers. And I did speak about the project at that BYU Women's Conference. The other question is, would I recommend this to other wards? I think it would be a great thing, but it was so much effort on the part of so many people, and I think our committee meetings were very important in helping us keep energized about this project. I would go home just aghast at what I had agreed to do at each meeting, and there were people, I was not the only person who put in many, many, many hours. People say, oh, this would be great, and I'd like to have my ward do it, but it's a bigger commitment, I think, than anybody can imagine. I think, and we tried to think of shortcuts. I thought of asking people to write their personal histories and turn them in, but we decided nobody would do it, so we just went out with our tape recorders and did what we could. Other questions? Yes. In the back,
I just wanted to make a comment, actually.
Do you want to come to the mic and comment? So I don't have to repeat it and mess it up.
I just wanted to comment briefly. I was given this book to read by Scott Abbott when I was visiting at BYU as a non-LDS professor. And this book was so useful to me in understanding my students and where they came from and who they were. Because coming from the outside, Mormonism is very monolithic. It looks very monolithic, and it also looks very forbidding. And especially if you're coming from a liberal, secular, humanist background. And I did not expect to find the diversity that I found among my students at BYU. And this book really helped me understand why they were diverse and how they were diverse. And it's an enormous service, I think, to your church that this book was produced. And I just wish that more people knew about it, because if more people knew about it, they would know and understand a lot more about Mormonism. So I wanted to thank Susan for that.
Thank you. Yes.
I think I would wish, I haven't read the book, but I would wish that the depth of feeling and revelation, personal revelation that was done, that's exposed in that book, would be something that would be in my ward, or in a regular ward. And sometimes there's a lot of difficulty in really getting down to bedrock and really sharing your true insights and feelings. Was there resistance on the part of people at that time, any fears in really sharing themselves? And do you think you'd have any difference if you tried the project today?
Okay. So the question is, was there resistance to sharing their lives so openly, and do I think I would get the same sort of results today? There were some people who did not want to be interviewed, and we just said, okay. I think people really were quite, I mean, people like to tell their stories. That's I think, something about human beings. They like to tell. Would I have the same results? Well, doing it all by myself, I'm not sure. I think the fact that it was a ward project and it was something we were all doing together, just as a ward, we made Easter eggs to raise money for our welfare assessment and our budget, or we did other things together as a ward. This project kind of took on that nature for members of the ward. And so when I said, I want to set up an interview, they said, oh, yeah, okay, that's great. You know, whether a person could go in as a, you know, and get people to open up that way, just saying, I'm going to write a book about your ward. I don't know. You could try. Brian.
I have a comment that kind of responds to the last two.
Do you want to come to the mic?
Sure.
I think that, is it Linda? Is that who? I think that Linda's comment and then the last question both have something to do with how I responded when I first read the book. And at first I thought the same thing maybe Toby said, that I wish my ward were this diverse. And that was my first reaction. My second reaction was more of what Linda said, that it helped me see that the diversity is there, and that it's just that we are not very open, as you said. And when I read this, I was in a ward that I was not comfortable in, and I wasn't going to church more than maybe once every 4 or 5 weeks. Because I didn't feel comfortable with the ward, and I didn't feel like they had opened themselves to me, and I didn't want to open myself to them. They were all students. They were all my age. They were all married and on their Franklin Planner trip to the Celestial Kingdom, and I didn't fit in there. And we happened to switch not long after I read this, which it was very healing for me to read, because it reminded me of why I love being a Mormon, and how Mormons are weird, and I like how weird the people are in the book, and I like them, and it made me realize I'm weird, and I like that. And I went to another ward, and this ward I tried to take a different approach, and that I allowed myself to become active in home teaching callings, and I went home teaching to people who I know that if I had been more revealing than I was, faster than I was, they would not have wanted me to come home teaching to them. But by the time I asked them their stories and they started telling me theirs, I was able to tell them who I was, and they were comfortable with that. And I had, it's funny that this is the panel, but I had an interesting experience that a member of the Elders Quorum Presidency asked me to go home teaching with him to Toby's son, who was in my second ward, because he knew that I read Sunstone and Dialogue, and he knew that Toby's son read Sunstone and Dialogue, and he thought that we might get along in a way that he didn't. And he wasn't there the time I went, but I talked to his daughter-in-law, and she was really happy to have the home teacher come, who was happy to see Sunstone on the table. And so those are the kind of things that that was just my comment, that it helped me, like Linda said, recognize the diversity in what otherwise would just be a homogenous ward, and it made me want to share my stories with these people and listen to what they have to say, and I don't care if I don't agree with them.
They preached it better than she was.
Doesn't that sound just about like this?
Yeah.